get a sound check.
Your project's mentioned in this. This is great. Are you going to the dinner also?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm creating something that you will see at the dinner.
Oh, good. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
We're doing the exhibit that we have at the Historical Society. Yeah. We're doing a sort of video montage incorporating the photos.
Yeah. How long is the exhibit up for?
I think through August. Yeah, it's really...
Brooklyn Historical Society, mm-hmm. Pierpont, right?
128 Pierpont. Yeah. So it's Clinton.
My son goes to Grace School.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm on that block every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Carroll Gardens.
Oh, so you're right down the street. Yeah. All right. We're good. So we are rolling. Today is May 15th, 2008. I'm Sadie Sullivan with the Brooklyn Historical Society, and I am here at 110 William Street with Rob Walsh. If you would introduce yourself to the recording however you like.
Okay, I'm Rob Walsh. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Small Business Services for the City of New York.
Mm-hmm. And what is your date of birth for the archive?
Sure, it's 1959.
Oh,
well, thank you very much.
So what is your connection to Bed-Stuy restoration like today?
Okay. There's a number of connections. We work with Bed-Stuy, particularly with restoration, on a number of different projects. Some of them are involve the revitalization of the neighborhood. It could be improving storefronts on the street, capital plans and improvements in and around restoration. And then, most recently, we've initiated a number of workforce development programs. We are in charge of the adult job programs and training for the city, so we work hand-in-hand with restoration and a number of the community organizations in the area. I think of Black Vets as an example of that, where we're working together with them and getting people jobs.
Oh, that's great. Black Vets for Social Justice.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, neat. And how did that collaboration come about between your offices and restoration?
Well, the collaboration goes back, years. When I got here in 2002, it had, unfortunately weakened. And I think maybe it was... just sort of a disconnect, if you will, between this office and restoration. I came in at about the same time as Colvin Granum, and we hit it off. And I've always been curious about Bed-Stuy and Bed-Stuy restoration. I've run a local development corporation myself up at Union Square and 14th Street, and that was. I faced some of the same things he did, and maybe not of the same magnitude, but I was curious about Bedford-Stuyvesant because of the history is just amazing. It's the first community development corporation of its kind in the city of New York. I am a fanatical fan of the work that Robert Kennedy did. And I can remember reading about the effort in Bed-Stuy when I was in grad school. And I went to Fordham University, and Fordham University was also in an area that had a lot of urban decay and vacancies and high crime. And it was sort of neat to look at this effort that was taking place in restoration, the sense of hope of pulling together community leaders and business leaders, and the work that Robert Kennedy did and Jacob Javits and attracting IBM and various foundations. I think of the Ford Foundation, quickly. I think of the work that Franklin Thomas did. And pooling resources to lift a community, and it's just been a fascination of mine. So it was sort of a natural that when I got to this job, I reach out, one, to deal with my own curiosity, but two, to do my job and see what we could do to better help Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Mm-hmm. So as Restoration being the first CDC, do you see its influence in other groups that you work with?
I see Restoration's influence on a lot of fronts. I have to believe that the efforts that took place at Restoration were a rationale and a reason why so many other organizations came together. I think of Greater Jamaica and Queens. I think the South Bronx, you know, revitalization effort. And the concept, if you think about it, is fairly simple. It is getting people in a room together, elected officials, community leaders, business leaders, and pooling resources and thinking about how could we end up making this a better place and a better community, and what will it take, and what kind of vision do we need? And, you know, I sort of my own work, you know, I started my career in city government. I worked in the Koch administration from 1981 to 1989. And I ended up going up to Union Square in 89 when there was a lot of vacancies around Union Square where the park was unsafe, where we had crack houses dotting the eastern corridor of 14th Street. And I had the opportunity to work with a real visionary, a real creative guy by the name of Jonathan Fanton, who's now, he was then the president of the New School for Social Research, now called New School University. And then became the head of the MacArthur Foundation, where he is now. And Jonathan was one of those leaders in many ways, like Robert Kennedy, you know, putting people together around a table and saying, we can make this neighborhood better. This is unacceptable, you know, the conditions as they are today. I, as a president of New School, want to invest more in the neighborhood, and NYU should be investing in the neighborhood, and we could end up attracting more businesses to the area. And we should not be looking the other way when crimes are committed on the street, and we should be doing something about it. And we should, you know, invest in the public school, in that case Washington Irving High School, to make it a better place. And we should be building affordable housing. So, you know, I got my own taste of it, you know, for 8 years at Union Square. And, you know, when Colvin Granum was here 2 days ago, sitting with me and just catching up and chatting, you know, I couldn't help but, you know, sort of smile about the work he's doing. He's building housing. The Billie Holiday Theater is being, you know, renovated. The wall that sort of separated the plaza from Fulton Street is down. It's opening up the plaza, and I think it's more than just symbolic. I think it's It tells you sort of about the times, about, you know, we don't have to have everything turn inward because we're afraid. There's a whole effort to create a wall of fame, if you will, or a walk of fame that highlights the work, whether it's Kennedy or Javits or Clarence Thomas or, you know, so many other wonderful people, Judge Jones, that have done a tremendous thing of lifting, you know, just lifting, you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant. And, you know, you're seeing such signs, I mean, such wonderful signs. Food Town, the investment that the Katz family has made, not only in just opening up a first-rate grocery store, but providing, you know, wonderful customer service and a high quality, I think is one of the, you know, best grocery stores in the city. The banks have returned to Bedford-Stuyvesant. There are at least two branches, you know, from the top of my head that I know that are in restoration. A white tablecloth restaurant has opened up, which has sent a signal of hope for everything else. And restoration under Colvin Granum and his leadership is back on track in such a big way and such a powerful way that it hasn't for years. I would say for decades. And that is, you know, it's good for Bedford-Stuyvesant, but it's also, you know, just great for New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You touched upon it, but how would you describe Bed-Stuy today as a neighborhood as a whole?
You know, when Jack Newfield wrote about, you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant in his book, on Robert Kennedy. He devoted a chapter the chapter said, giving a damn about hell. Bedford Stuyvesant, giving a damn about hell. And, 40 years ago, he wrote about debris. He wrote about a sense of hopelessness. He talked about joblessness. And just a real difficult time in the community. And there's still real challenges. There's still, an unacceptable level of unemployment. There are still some problems of vacancies along, some of the corridors. There's still a great need for affordable housing. But there's so much more now. When I'm out in Bedford-Stuyvesant and I'm walking up and down the streets and I stop in the new bakery that just opened up across from the coffee shop Mayor Bloomberg honored them last year at our neighborhood awards. It's called Bush Baby. And if you sit in Bush Baby, I don't know if you've been there, but go. I'll get you the address after this interview.
Yeah.
If you sit in Bush Baby and you hold on to a cup of coffee, you see something powerful taking place. You see women with baby strollers coming in and, in the afternoon for a cup of coffee and a place to sit down. You see others, maybe they have a yoga mat under their arm, and this is their place. And it's their place to chat. It's their place to get together with friends. It's their place to look out on the street. And, and across the street, there is a wonderful bakery, and the name escapes me, for the moment. And the same type of thing is taking place at the bakery. And what we need to do is to continue that. The bed and breakfast that opened up, that opened up shop just off of Fulton Street. Our job, and I guess one of my jobs, is to continue to encourage that entrepreneurial spirit and recognize it. And I think that's one of the reasons the mayor created an agency, devoted to small business and helping small businesses and going, storefront to storefront to help these businesses and make it. There's a lot of discussion in New York right now about the suburbanization of New York and how Rite Aid and CVS and bank branches and Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks have created a, outdoor mall, if you will, in many neighborhoods. Well, I think we have an opportunity, in Bed-Stuy to do it right and see what we can end up doing to create and generate many of these, small businesses from the ground up. And it's a conversation I have with Colvin on a regular basis, and it's one of the reasons why he's out there doing some of the commercial revitalization and organizing some of the merchants along Fulton Street to create a business improvement district where they end up paying in for the cleanup of their streets and have a marketing plan and get, more people to come and explore and dedicate themselves to the communities. And there are examples where that has taken place in other parts of the city that are applicable to Bedford-Stuyvesant, and some of that has taken place, but we still have a lot more work to do.
What are some neighborhoods that you would hold up as examples of?
I live in Carroll Gardens. I would say Smith Street. My great aunt lived in the house where I now live. My family came from Ireland in 1896 and 94. They settled on 4th Street in Clinton. I have all the paperwork to prove it. They came from Northern Ireland. They had 5 kids. My great aunt, had 5. Taught at St. Mary's Star of the Sea for 52 years, and I can remember, visiting her when we were kids. Now we didn't get invited over too often because I'm one of 7 kids, so no one invites a family of 7 over. Nobody, unless you're insane. But I can remember, Smith Street, where it was roughed up. and there were vacancies, and there was high crime and difficulty. It's hard to believe that, you know, today. You know, I can remember Union Square, the same thing. You know, I was telling some folks here that I could remember taking the job at Union Square in 1989, 1990, and having 24 vacancies on the block between 2nd and 3rd Avenue on 14th Street.
Impossible to imagine vacancies. That.
I can remember the sites, you know, where Barnes & Noble was empty, where the coffee shop now exists was empty. Well, that wasn't empty. It was a run-down place. But many of the places around the square were empty. And I think there's this sort of a thread, if you will. If you could get people, and I think this is what Colvin Granum does so well, is get people in a room and listen and chat and talk and create a vision and give people a sense of hope, you know, something powerful will happen. It's sort of like throwing that rock in a pond and the ripple effect that takes place. I think restoration, what's happening at restoration is in many ways, it's been described in some cases like a mini town hall, if you will. I mean, it sounds corny, but you know, if you go to restoration, it's in some ways a beachhead, and you build off of that, and you animate that ground floor. You know, Billie Holiday underway, Food Town underway. You know, the banks are back in. The plaza is being restored. Tenants are coming in. There's a small college presence there. There's a lot of youth programs there. The community board is there. There's a restaurant there that's opened, for the first time in along that corridor in a very, very long time. So what more do you need? A farmer's market, solidify, some of those vacancies that, Colvin was telling me about the other day down on Albany Street. And get more residential housing, along the way, but making sure, on the ground floor of those residential, that you put more storefronts on the ground floor. So I think we're along the right track, and it's something that you're not just looking at Fulton Street. There is purchasing power, and there's really a tremendous amount of purchasing power that's taking place in Bed-Stuy. Families, primarily African American families, middle income, upper income, working class families, who have put, in some cases, their life savings into restoration of the brownstones, and that I think that purchasing power can, and I'm an optimist, will show. In some of the commercial corridors that you're seeing around, I keep talking about Fulton Street because it's one of the main arteries back to downtown Brooklyn, and the connection to the A train. But you got Bridge Street and you got Malcolm X Boulevard and so many other places that are also seeing some of the same signs of growth and a renaissance that's taken place. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it's also housing, and the housing, and Bed-Stuy, unlike many, Bed-Stuy Restoration, unlike many other local development corporations, isn't hesitant to, step forward with a bold vision and saying, we're going to be in the housing business. When I was at Union Square, I was always hesitant to get into a business that I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at, and it's nice to see that determination of what's taking place with the restoration.
Mm-hmm. In terms of housing, how do you balance, or how will restoration balance? How does a community development corporation balance the need for economic development and then that fear that through development you might price some people out of the neighborhood?
Well, I'm a little bit out of my league on housing and affordable housing, but my conversations with Colvin and with Sean Donovan, the housing commissioner, we have the most aggressive affordable housing program that has ever taken place in the history of the city. And, you know, I can't get into the formulas and ratios, but many of these programs are geared to the working families. And in some cases, it's permanent housing for low-income people. It is a fine balance in some cases, you know, where you have, you know, the brownstones that are going for, in some cases, shells, $500,000 to $1 million, and others, you know, some of the new housing that you're talking about is new low-income housing. And the neat thing that I have noticed about low-income housing that has taken place is this care into not just putting up a whole bunch of units and not being concerned about those safety nets, you know, on the ground floor, whether it's you know, it's a mini school or daycare or health facilities, and making some of those, or jobs, and making those linkages. And I think that is the important part of it, is you know, when you're building low income housing or affordable housing, making sure that the people you are giving the keys to have a support network. And that's something that's certainly on Colvin Granum's mind. It's I know it's on the Housing Commission's mind, because I've had conversations with them about it. And you know, the fact that you have more and more nonprofits in the business, you know, working with developers to put it together is a good sign.
Do you think that the need for restoration has changed over the years?
Well, that's interesting. That's a great question. I think they've been able to abandon their, they've been able to expand their portfolio in many ways. You know, it's many organizations on a community level. If you look at it and you look back and you look at the history of many organizations, often they're created during a crisis and a crisis time. The resurrection, if you will, of Bryant Park in Midtown was a sort of an outcry to the crime and prostitution and just blatant criminality that took place, you know, behind the New York Public Library. Times Square is probably another example of that, where I saw a little bit of myself of things that were done in a crisis mode at Union Square. I can remember, you know, on the corner of 17th and Broadway, when I got there in the late 80s, early 90s, you had 5 senseless murders that took place in a nightclub, and it really rallied people together. And I think what Robert Kennedy did with Jacob Javits and leaders like Franklin Thomas and others is they rallied people together during a real crisis, health crisis, housing crisis, you know, public safety crisis, and so many others, and gave the community a sense of purpose and hope, you know, to build on. I think it's Bed-Stuy is in a much more solid footing now. And with a solid footing become, you know, you have many more partners. And when you have many more partners, there's a lot more consensus building and community, you know, development that has to take place. But these are different times. But at the same time, it's, you got to be careful not to be complacent. And you have to be careful of not, you know, it's sort of a, with many of these community development organizations, it's how big is your portfolio going to be, and can you do them all well? And you know, what are the things that are important in the community? You know, and when you talk to Colvin Granum, he'll talk about the arts and culture. He'll talk about the kids and making sure that there's programs for the kids. He'll certainly talk about affordable housing, financial literacy, that people are not taking advantage of, and it's important that people are opening up checking accounts and looking out to provide stability for their families. certainly public safety, attraction of small businesses, and also anchors, larger restaurants and other attractions, you know, in the area. Those are all things that when a neighborhood is a lot more stable and you're not in a crisis mode, you can begin, you know, thinking about in a much more deliberate way. And I think, you know, certainly, you know, Bed-Stuy has turned the corner in that way.
Mm-hmm. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn.
I was born
in Bay Ridge, and grew up in Bensonhurst. It's hard to believe, you know, I was one of the Italian mother, Irish father.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of two Irish kids in the class with a whole bunch of Irish nuns, so I was always given a little bit of a probably a wink and a nod on some of the grades, probably.
Where was everybody else? What was the background of the other kids in the class?
Italian.
It was all Italian.
Primarily an Italian-Jewish neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
86th Street, Bay Parkway, in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so, born in Brooklyn. My family left when I was a teenager, moved up to Dutchess County. I did my high school in a small town, in a town called Amenia, New York, about 100 miles north of here. And I came back to school to go to Fordham. And I got a political science degree and my master's degree there. I did a fellowship with the city Koch administration and ended up staying there for in the Koch administration for 8 years and then went up to Union Square.
Mm-hmm. And so are both of your parents from Brooklyn?
Both are.
Where did, I know the Irish side was from, Smith Street.
Originally from Smith Street. My mother's family from Italy, but settled in Bensonhurst.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was Bensonhurst, it's still pockets of it, was a very strong Italian neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a total side question, but it's a personal fascination.
Sure.
With doing these oral histories, it's really interesting to me the fruit trees in people's backyards and Italian families and fruit trees.
Yeah.
And in different, and I've come at it from many different perspectives.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if you do you have memories at all or grandparents with fruit trees?
I tell you what the memories I have of our backyard in Brooklyn and Bensonhurst is the fact that my grandmother would tell me stories about the fact that the members of the Three Stooges used to live right next to them on 81st Street. I still remember our address as a kid. And they used to knock down the fence. Mo, Larry, and Curly, right? They lived right next to my my grandmother. And just telling me about the stories, and she would, you know, when she was getting up in her age, she would sort of do it with sort of a laugh and a smile about how she would wet them down with the hose to get them to go back in their yard. But not fruit trees. I can remember. You still see it in Carroll Gardens in some ways. It's sort of disappearing now. The art of pigeon collection. You know, but more and more that stuff is disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness, in my own opinion. But
oh, I like the pigeons.
You do or don't?
I do like the pigeons. Well, at least, you know, I like to see them when they're swooping. So when you were in Brooklyn and when you moved upstate, what did you used to hear about Bed-Stuy at that time? What was your thoughts of Bed-Stuy?
Naive. I was naive about Bed-Stuy. It was sort of a whole different world. I did not have a handle on what Bed-Stuy meant. Until more so when I was in college and grad school, and I was just curious about neighborhoods and why certain neighborhoods were the way they were. And, you know, a belief that it goes beyond race. And, you know, I lived off campus at the Fordham University campus. And, I lived in a small town upstate New York, and there was rural poverty in you know, pockets of where I lived. And I'm, you know, from a working class family of, you know, one of seven. But, you know, seeing block after block, you know, sort of being burnt out and junkies sort of living out of these, you know, abandoned buildings, you know, on my way to my apartment, sort of opened my eyes. And then I, you know, read about organizations like the Northwest Bronx Clergy Coalition, and I got interested in this. And obviously, you know, I think the Jesuits had something to do with that, and the education of Fordham, and, you know, sort of reaching out in the community and what could you end up doing, and seeing soup kitchens, you know, sort of pop up, and at that point of helping people who couldn't help themselves. And this is a book I picked up. This is a book I picked up, you know, back when. I don't know when the first edition came out, but I just remember, you know, I remember having this book with me.
Just for the audio, it's the
this
RFK.
This is RFK, a memoir that Jack Newfield wrote. And he came out with this book in 1969. You know, I was reading this in the late 70s, early 80s. And I just became fascinated about neighborhoods and you know, how do you end up making things happen? And I went into government with that sense of optimism. I remember when I was an urban fellow, a New York City urban fellow in the Koch administration, I remember touring the Fort Apache area in the South Bronx and still sort of wondering, you know, how could this be? And then I got to, you know, have my own little taste of it, if you will, with a, you know, career opportunity up at Union Square to try to make something happen up in that area. Maybe not to the extent of Bed-Stuy, but an area that, you know, needed a lift and pulling people together and making things happen. And that led me, you know, from there to doing some of the same stuff that I got recruited out of New York. I was in Charlotte, North Carolina for 5 years. And I got recruited to help them shape and build their city and animate it and add some energy on the streets and, you know, a big effort on building housing and building out their transportation system and attracting, you know, businesses. And I was there for 5 years until the mayor recruited me back to run small businesses.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, in terms of neighborhood character, you touched upon this, that focusing on small businesses is helpful for maintaining neighborhood character?
I think people want to, and I'm seeing this more and more. I just did a tour with the restaurant great Danny Meyer from Union Square Cafe. Sort of interesting what we did. Is we went into a number of different Brooklyn neighborhoods, and this might be of interest to you on a different subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I went with Danny, and we went to a number of people that were trained by him, but had the bug to create their own place. And we walked up and down Fifth Avenue. And I don't know what it is about Fifth Avenue and Park Slope, but every time I go back, there's something new. A new pastry shop, a new restaurant, a new bar, a new cafe, a new kid shop, a new, you know, and it's now gotten, you know, when I came back to New York in 2002, there were still areas that were still weak, if you will, in terms of the retail corridor. And a lot of that has been alive, you know, and we went from there to Carroll Gardens, to Williamsburg, of all these different entrepreneurs and creative people, and you see the same thing taking place on Van Brunt Street, you know, in Red Hook. Whether it's the outdoor garden shop now, the Chelsea Garden place that has come in, or the wine shop, or Good Fork, or some of these others. And there's something special about that, because it's, you know, we all have this mentality in New York. I don't know what it is. It's like, you got to see this, and it's mine. And, you know, whether it's a family member or someone who lives in Manhattan, you know, who's coming to the Brooklyn, you sort of want to show that off. And I find myself, you know, if we got in the car and we went out to Bush Baby, they would recognize me, the mother and son who run that place. I would hope they do, because I'm, you know, every time I'm out there, I stop in and say hello and talk and chat, and it's sort of neat. It's my place.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? And I think there's a little bit of an art to doing that, of putting those pieces together, of, you know, places that are open and encourage people to come in and out. And I think we're getting a foothold in Bedford-Stuyvesant on that. If we're talking about a bed and breakfast, you know, opening up, which is, and the owner's name escapes me, the woman who runs that, I've heard her speak, and she's very inspirational, and a bakery and a coffee shop, you know, what's next? You know, okay, got the restaurant that's opened up, and, you know, what about a farmer's market and a plaza on Saturdays?
That'd be awesome.
That's not far off, you know. It's not far off. And, you know, the Billie Holiday Theater being renovated, and, you know, what else? And, you know, what other investments are going to be taking place in such a powerful and historical area? I think our job, you know, whether it's government or, you know, community organizations, is to ensure it does keep that flavor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about in terms of race, which is something that I've heard talked about in terms of the development, and then who's going to be buying in the neighborhood? And
you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant at one point was a primarily a white upper class neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you trace back and look at the history, it has now become, you know, obviously, you know, strongly African American community, and primarily is now. But you still you're seeing some of a mix of and I think that's, you know, healthy for neighborhoods when there is an openness to all races and people of color, and but I understand what, you know, the concern that I hope the concern is not race. I hope the concern is more about the fear of gentrification. And because I think race relations, you know, in this city are the best I've seen in my lifetime. And, you know, you want to make sure that that's, you know, I think an aggressive effort on building a more affordable housing, and making sure that there is enough of affordable housing on the market, is one of the ways to, you know, deal with that issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you feel? This is, I'll read directly the question. What do you feel is restoration's most important role and legacy?
Their legacy certainly is. What Robert Kennedy talked about when he stood out in Bed-Stuy in December of 1966 with a whole bunch of community leaders and government officials and heads of businesses, and talked about a vision going forward and a direction. And restoration has done that, taking an old milk factory and converting it into, if you will, the City Hall of Bed-Stuy, and a place for people to get educated, to eat, to visit government officials, to come together as a community and around a table. And the stakes are different now. But I think that is still the same. And, you know, when Colvin Granum and his staff and the board, you know, come together and they start talking about, okay, you know, where do we go from here? You know, what are our priorities? You know, what can we do on the smallest of things to the largest of things? It's exactly what they were, you know, some of the leaders were talking about, you know, 42 years ago, almost 42 years ago now, is, you know, setting a sense of direction and a powerful sense of direction going forward. I think the difference now is that it's something I touched on before, is it's not as great a crisis. You know, some people would say, yes, it is still a crisis. If unemployment is in double digits and, you know, the schools are not where we are, you know, that still is, my friend, a crisis. And they're right about that. And you know, I think it's all our jobs to, all those folks who are involved in restoration or Bed-Stuy community in one way or another, is to keep that sense of urgency. And that is, and keep raising the bar of excellence to, you know, to the next level.
What about in terms of, well, I can, because I sort of think about it in terms of that, the next level being the arts and cultural hub idea. Can you speak to that, to the Billie Holiday? And
yeah, I don't think it's enough to have, you know, Billie Holiday is great, you know, and the, you know, some of the shows that are there are wonderful. I've been out, and now, you know, you could go to a show, you could go to a restaurant, you could go to a coffee shop, you could stroll along, you could, you know, take in. But I think you need to build off of that, and the gallery is, you know, certainly another piece of that. I believe it's the Skylight Gallery, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And, you know, promoting some of the artwork of folks, you know, in that arts culture, you know, there's a reason why. There's an article in the New York Times today. I think it's Jersey City. I skimmed through it really quickly about creating a cultural district, and that's what has to take place in. You know, in Bedford-Stuyvesant is promoting the arts and culture from a whole mess of different ways, whether it's the Billie Holiday Theater or the gallery, or there's a building at the back of Restoration that has programs for kids, and that is important. Programs that come out of the nearby YMCA. How do you do more of that? Something Colvin and I have talked about has been recognizing some of the leadership that has, you know, that's been there, and how do you do it through this Walk of Fame or Hall of Fame, or, you know, other ways of memorializing, you know, some of the work that has been, you know, done in those areas,
mm-hmm.
but also looking for other opportunities where you can end up opening up other opportunities for the arts, and having a cluster, if you will, of attractions. Mm-hmm. That's what you want to do. You know, the Weeksville Historical. Pamela, is it Pamela Green?
Yep.
Pamela Green runs that, and a lot of people in New York still don't know about that. You know, these are the things that you need to end up, you know, promoting, and then you end up thinking about how you end up taking, you know, some of the things that you have, and developing relationships with restaurants and other attractions, you know, in the area, so they come, you know, they come together.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge as a neighborhood develops is making sure it's still affordable for, you know, many of these arts organizations that, you know, artists are an unbelievable breed. They are often risk adverse. I'm sorry, I said risk adverse. They're often the ones that will take the risk,
mm-hmm.
and go into a neighborhood and build the neighborhood and make it cool and secure, and people want to come to it. And unfortunately, they're the ones that often get displaced, you know, during the best of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we probably have the best cultural affairs commissioner we've ever had in the city of New York, and Kate Levin. And, you know, this is something Kate has talked about, you know, artist housing, and how do you end up having more work, live workplaces that take place. I think of what's happened in Bruckner Boulevard in the Bronx. I think of what's happened out in Red Hook above the fairway. You know, some of that is artist housing. And, you know, how do we end up doing that, and, you know, developing a greater cluster of sort of homegrown art?
Mm-hmm.
And then I wouldn't forget, you know, in terms of the ties back to BAM and the programming that more and more is taking place at BAM and showcasing homegrown talent coming out of Bed-Stuy,
mm-hmm.
and the Fort Greene and the Clinton area. And, you know, there's nothing greater than a sense of hope of aspiring artists that they could end up showcasing their talents to a national, international audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell my wife is in the arts business, can't you? I've been taught well. She ran the Brooklyn College Performing Arts Center for a number of years.
Oh, wow.
So, and she now runs the Tony Bennett Foundation. So I am well schooled. So if you're listening, Sherry.
That's great. Yeah. That's excellent. Well, we've covered most of the general areas that we wanted to discuss. I ask you some specifics about the plaza redesign? We talked about that a bit, but your involvement, your ideas.
Well, I when I got involved, I've been involved on this in terms of reshaping money to get to the plaza redesign. It can't happen fast enough. It is one of these special places in New York that used to be the skating rink, right? I have it in my head, those black and white photos of Robert Kennedy and his kids going around the skating rink and other people enjoying the skating rink. And it's such a special place, a special plaza. And, we should recognize some of the people who've done it by adding some sort of history and, you know, bring it out through artistic sculpture or whatever. There's something more that should be done in the plaza, and energizing it and animating it. And I don't, you know, maybe it's, you know, there's an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about David Rockwell building a playground, you know, high energy, creative playground right here in the South Street Seaport. Maybe that's what's needed, you know. But something that is a great attraction of people. Playgrounds often do that. Farmers markets often do that. Other places, you know, getting people to, you know, congregate in that area. And the good news is that there's new market tax credits available now. And there's money that Councilman Van, who's been so dedicated to restoration over the years, I mean, the guy's been amazing, quite frankly, and he's earmarked and allocated millions of dollars in money, plus, you know, you take the money he has allocated plus new market tax credits, and restoration has a architect that they're working with. I think his name is Garrison, Jim Garrison, if I'm not mistaken. Who's been establishing a game plan of what could work in that area. And with the wall down and it opening up onto the plaza, and people could be sitting outside and perhaps having a cup of coffee and walking around, I think it's going to be good. Now, the other thing is, you know, and this is on Colvin's mind, is it's not just the plaza, but it's the renovation of the parking garage and the structure itself, the office space. And those things that, you know, you often don't see that, you know, the amount of work that goes into some of this, the infrastructure. But unfortunately, for years, there's a lot of deferred maintenance, and it caught up with them. And now is the time where a lot of that stuff has been renovated so we could get a return of tenants, if you will, in some of those upper floors. And I think it's a challenge. You got to animate that ground floor and the plaza, and, you know, having different programming and activities that take place, whether it's an outdoor movie or a market or farmers or kids or playground. But you also have to pay attention to those upper floors. And, you know, you need to sort of repopulate it, if you will, you know, with people who are going to come out at lunch and take advantage of some of the new restaurants and bookstores and coffee shops that you want to also come into the area, whether it's in the Restoration Plaza, across the street, or down the block.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That connects to the... Oh, I thought this was off. I must not have pushed off the button. Where is it? Sorry about that. The merchants, the business improvement district, mm-hmm. On Fulton Street.
Sure.
If you can speak to that.
The city of New York now has 59 business improvement districts throughout the five boroughs. Mayor Bloomberg has created 15 of them, and we have a good number that are in the hopper, if you will, to be created. The Bed-Stuy, they're calling it the Gateway, on Fulton is one of them that is in a good position, and they're talking about a budget of $675,000 that would will go for three different areas: cleanliness, safety, and marketing. And the cleanliness will mean that, you know, when keeping shops clean in front of the storefront in the streets, removing litter, emptying the trash cans on busy days on a regular basis, working with our Department of Sanitation to get rid of it, getting rid of graffiti that every once in a while, unfortunately, appears on storefronts and pull-down gates or on the mailboxes, and paying attention block by block of those details of keeping a block much more beautified. And some business improvement districts, and my hope is, you know, it can happen in Bed-Stuy, I know it can happen, is doing some plantings, if you will, whether it's, you know, planted pots. And, you know, I was just up in Grand Central today. It's beautiful. Who would have ever thought, you know, these just plantings and you know, when it looks good and it feels good, it also, I think, has an impact on the safety.
Mm-hmm.
People notice neglect, and people who sometimes are all up to no good see it as a sign of nobody's here, nobody's watching, no one cares.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the cleanliness and appearance go hand in hand with the not only perception but perhaps maybe the reality of public safety.
Mm-hmm.
I know people have written about that, the broken windows theory that George Kelling often talks about. He's a professor out at Rutgers University. You know, I'm out there a lot. I'm out in the, you know, neighborhoods quite a bit. But on a day like today, I'd like to be out there. But I was in Flushing last week, speaking to their group out in Flushing, Queens, It's tremendous what they've done. The neighborhoods are much more clean, and it feels, you know, a lot better. And I think what the Business Improvement District will do for Fulton Street is it will help the neighborhood get even cleaner. Working with the police precinct on keeping the neighborhood safe, whether they have patrols or not, I don't know how they're allocating the budget. Marketing, you know, some of the new businesses and some of the existing businesses and some of the arts and entertainment, whether it's a website, whether it's activities that take place, all of those things are, you know, important, that whole marketing and doing the marketing right. And then probably the most important thing that a business improvement district can do is having the staff, the executive director, do what I used to do. Go block by block, storefront to storefront, get to know the, you know, merchants, know their names, know their hours, see what their issues are, see if they can help with the city, pull them together, get them engaged, get them to think beyond their front door and think in a much more holistic manner. And, you know, sometimes we don't know our neighbors, in the buildings we live in. I mean, it's an unfortunate thing. It's not just a New York thing. I would say the same thing is applies to streets and storefronts. And the ones, neighborhoods on that level who have really lifted them up are the ones that say, you know what, we're going to get together. There is power in numbers. And, you know, the captain of the precinct is going to be paying a lot of attention to you. You know, if a whole bunch of people end up showing up at the different boards that they have on the local level. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen on Fulton Street. It's going to take the services to a local level, and, you know, the concept of a business improvement district is that the property owners and merchants are paying for that service. So there's a real sense of ownership in terms of where those dollars are spent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about workforce development?
Workforce is an ongoing challenge, and it's one of the things that we're working together with, whether it's the Black Veterans for Social Justice or restoration. There's a number of different things that we've been doing on workforce, and it dovetails with some of the existing programs that Colvin Granum has. We have our career center that has been opened up at 9 Bond Street, which is in the Fulton Mall area. Bond in Fulton. It's a beautiful facility. It's run by Goodwill Industries. And we've been placing thousands of people out of that center on all sorts of different jobs, on the lowest level jobs. They could be working in the nearby IHOP or the Target or, you know, some of the stuff at Atlantic Terminal, manufacturing, industrial jobs, Fairway, you name it. It's been a number of different places. And the access, you know, it's a couple of stops away from Bed-Stuy on the A line. But that's not enough. It's certainly not enough. And we've been doing some career advancement programs with restoration and getting people who are at the lower levels and getting up to higher jobs. And I think that's a challenge that we're working with restoration. It's too early to tell, you know, in terms of how much, how well we've done. I think we're off to a good start. I think the concept is right, and it's something that we just need to keep working at. If you look at maps of Bedford-Stuyvesant, unfortunately, sometimes there's a real strong correlation between the concentration of public housing and unemployment.
Mm.
And we've been tackling it. We've been really going at it, and it is not an easy task to get people who have been out of work for the longest time into a position, if you will, again, to be employable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you job ready? And in some cases, it's much more intensive. In other cases, people are ready to go, you know, and go back to work. This is you know, we're out in the communities, we're making ties. I have a team here. It's our community partnership staff who are working with groups like Restoration to see, you know, what more we can end up doing in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Wish I had numbers for you, and I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but I can get them for you if you like, and the specifics of them.
Yeah, this is, I'm more interested in the ideas behind, so that's good. Do you think that there are ways that Restoration has failed to meet certain goals or expectations over the course of its whole lifespan?
I think Restoration went through a bit of a roller coaster. I think other people would say that in terms of its leadership. And it is on an upswing. I really feel that, you know, judging one by the momentum that they've created in a whole bunch of different areas, the relationship that they've developed with the Bloomberg administration, the accomplishments over time, whether it's workforce, whether it's some of the simple things of helping people with weatherization programs so people could save heating of their homes, which has become a lot more costly, to financial literacy. They've gotten so much better, and I attribute that a lot to the leadership. There was a time, I think, that there was a lot of deferred maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gone about developing a game plan to deal with that, and to do that in a very smart, smart way. But it's a telling sign of the health of an organization is when you see a interest in getting more organizations to foundations, partners, if you will, to invest in the organization. I mean, if you look over time, you know, what has been done, the Councilman Van has put millions of dollars into capital efforts. The borough president, Marty Markowitz, put, you know, and the mayor put money into the renovation of Billie Holiday Theater. There was money put in, you know, for, from the various foundations. I believe the Ford Foundation has engaged again in a very big way, with I think the numbers were to a $2 million grant, and I have a laundry list of other organizations: Robin Hood Foundation, the Cerdner Foundation, J.P. Morgan Chase, our organization is Small Business Services. And you and people like a winner, you know, and not only a winner, but they also is someone who's going to roll up their sleeves and tackle, you know, difficult problems and establish a vision and say, look, this is not going to happen overnight, but we have a sense of direction, and I think that's what's happening at Restoration right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Is there anything that I haven't thought to ask about that you'd like to?
No, I'm trying to think if there's anything. I'm trying to think if there is. I pounded away at a lot of key things that what I'm familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as familiar with some of the I'm familiar with Black Vets, I'm familiar with some of, but there's a lot of other organizations that are obviously also make up the Bedford-Stuyvesant community. But you covered a lot. We covered a lot.
Yes, the Black Vets for Social Justice. We have the other exhibit that we have up right now at the Historical Society is Brooklyn Vietnam veterans, and two of the vets are involved.
I gotta come out and see it.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
That one is particularly.
I gotta come see that.
Mm-hmm. What was your date of birth again? I'm just feeling. That's right.
1959.
So this gives the interview to both Restoration's archives and the Historical Society's archives.
This is wonderful. Thank you. Anything we could end up doing, if you want to work on other stuff, you let me know.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much.
I think someone should do Red Hook at some point.
Yeah. I have a friend of mine that has, oh goodness, what's it called now? Anyway, he has a gallery down there.
We gotta do Red Hook.
That's just wonderful. Yeah, it's
there's
a
so
really
much,
neat
there's
area.
So much history there.
Yeah. And now there's going to be the IKEA ferry, I heard, which, like, that's going to be crazy.
That's wild.
Yeah.
The IKEA ferry. It's hard to believe. I was in Red Hook this morning. I ran in Red Hook. I went down to the track. It was a quiet, beautiful track. And it's so peaceful and quiet. There were three people on the track this morning when I got up. I was on the track at about 6:15. And I just love it. The whole... being on the water and it's quiet and surprisingly a lot of parkland down there. So
yeah, and amazing views.
The views are just so powerful. Have you met Greg O'Connell?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, he's an owner of a lot of properties and he's restored a lot of property.
Mm.
So. Okay.
Great, thank you.
Well, this is wonderful.